As Muslims around the world celebrate the end of the holy month of Ramadan, Illinois Muslims have given away more than $500,000 towards charity. It's called zakat.
And zakat is also another type of sacrifice. It is financial sacrifice.
Zakat Chicago and the Islamic Society of Greater Springfield join us to explain how that money is being used to help those in need. Speaking of money, Illinois State Treasurer Mike Frericks joins us to talk about the budget situation in Illinois and how he's handling things. Plus, Peoria is working on a new way to solve its stormwater problem. And as officials fix that, they're helping green the city.
Standing out on a day like today, even though it's beautiful weather, in the sun is really uncomfortable. So it discourages people from walking. Those details are really important. You know, the street trees being spaced appropriately, so within maybe 10 years, you've got a canopy that provides shade for pedestrians.
We speak with Peoria's chief innovation officer about how they're doing. That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's a state treasurer's job to protect our state's tax dollars. That means making smart investments and managing debt. As a taxpayer, this is your money. Lately, the treasurer has said the state budget crisis is making his job much harder than it should be. That's Mike Frericks, our Illinois state treasurer. He's a Democrat. He's a former state senator and lives in Champaign, and he's here with me in studio. Treasurer, welcome to the 21st.
Nyla, good morning.
Good morning. As always, you are welcome to join the conversation. Those of you listening, the treasurer is happy to take any calls or questions you have. This is your opportunity to join us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Again, that's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show, our handle 21ST Show. Treasurer Frericks, in the first quarter of the year, your office said the state has lost out on nearly $8 million. That's just lost investment income. And even as we're looking at this short-term stopgap deal, the state's continuing to lose out on millions of dollars because of the year-long budget standoff we've had. Can you explain why?
Well, let me just clarify. We didn't lose money. We lost out on opportunity to make more money. So our investments are cautious. We don't lose principal. But if we're able to plan long-term, we're able to get higher interest rates and make more money to the state. Without a budget in place, it makes it really difficult to plan. Everyone understands if you have money available in your checking account and you just leave it there, your chances are you're not going to make any money off of that. If you know you're not going to need that money for a year and you can put it into a CD, you can make interest. That's what we try and do in the treasurer's office. We try and make sure that money is available to pay bills, that it's safe, but that we also earn a good return. And this uncertainty over the last year has helped us to lose out on missed opportunities.
Well, and not just uncertainty, obviously, and this isn't necessarily your office's role, but we're looking at the state adding additional amounts of fees and interest because of the bills that we haven't paid this year. So I guess if the state were a household, not only would we be getting hit with late fees on our credit cards, we wouldn't be saving for retirement, as you're saying.
We would be going into financial counseling if we were a household.
If we were a household, where would we even be in terms of how would you equate us as a financial household in terms of what we would look like?
We'd be spending more than we're taking in. And everyone knows that's a bad way to do things. But it's smaller things as well. The state just went out and issued debt for capital projects. This is something everyone knows you need to invest. If you own a house, you have to invest in the upkeep of that house. You have to make some expenditures for fear of the roof collapsing on you. These things you have to do. But if you have to go out and borrow, you want to do it at the lowest interest rates possible. We went out and borrowed right after a credit rating downgrade. That means it cost us more money. That's taking about $70 million out of Illinois taxpayers' wallets and sending it off to Wall Street. We shouldn't have done that. If we had our finances in order, we'd have a better credit rating and we'd be paying less interest there. People understand if you have a lower credit score, if you don't pay your bills on time, or you just skip out on paying your bills, your credit rating sinks. And then when you go to get a mortgage, the bank is less likely to loan to you, or they will loan to you at a higher interest rate. The state of Illinois has a lot of work to do and a lot of years of discipline to get back where we need to be.
I'm speaking with State Treasurer Mike Frericks. You can join us if you have questions or comments for him about any of this. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. And as you're talking about these downgrades, the state was just downgraded by both Moody's and S&P, and you sort of laid that out. I think we hear reports of downgrades, and as treasurer, I wonder what you want taxpayers to think when they hear another report about yet another downgrade for the state and its credit rating.
Well, they should understand that costs them money. You know, a lot of people have heard these downgrades for a while. They've heard these stories about a lack of a budget, and they've, I think, become complacent. And they say, oh, well, that's just Illinois. We've managed to get along for this last year or with this fight between the governor and the General Assembly. But there are real consequences. You know, that's $70 million we're paying in extra interest that we shouldn't have to. And this came from a U of I study. This is not my analysis. $70 million extra interest that could have gone into our schools and could have gone into our universities and could have gone to help our social service providers going forward. And I think the public ought, when they hear that, ought to realize it's costing them money out of their wallet.
Do you think the stopgap spending plan helped or made things worse?
Oh, it definitely helped. It is an improvement over what had been going on. I was glad to see the governor put his turnaround agenda aside and agreed to a six-month budget. Now, that clearly would have been a lot better if they had agreed to a full-year budget, if they had agreed to properly balance this budget, to tackle the tough choices of revenue and cuts this year. So this is an improvement, but it's nowhere near as good as we deserve.
You're a former state senator. I'm wondering if you felt like it was difficult to be treasurer this past legislative session and watch all of this play out. As your job is to watch over the state's investments, I wonder if you would describe it as a frustrating experience looking at everything that happened, both as someone who was a former member of the state house as well as now treasurer.
It sounds like you put words in my mouth, but those are exactly the words I use. Frustrating. You know, I served with Governors Blagojevich and Governor Quinn, and there was lots of fighting going on there between the General Assembly and the governor. We had disagreements. Sometimes it took us into August. One year took us into August to pass a budget. But at the end of the day, we had to get some sort of spending plan in place. And some tough decisions were made going forward. I feel like this last year and a half, I've watched my colleagues who stayed in the Senate, and it's been incredibly frustrating for me and for them. You know, in the past, you negotiated over a budget, and that means you negotiate over what kind of revenues to raise, what kind of cuts to make. This governor came in, and he brought in all kinds of other issues into the equation that made it impossible to actually negotiate a budget. And as Governor Edgar said, that's the first job of a governor. If you're going to govern, you have to have a budget in place.
What responsibility do you think the Democratic Party has in the state and Democratic lawmakers have now as we look at the next 6 months and we look at what comes after the election?
Well, nobody is without blame here. What they did is they passed a budget that will get them through the election, and they're set up to begin fighting again in January. And so I think what's important is for Democratic legislators and Republican legislators to make their case as to why their vision will move the state forward. And then the voters can choose. And if the voters increase Democratic majorities, it means they're rejecting Governor Rauner. If they like what Governor Rauner is trying to do to the state, they should vote for Republican legislators. He's putting a lot of money behind Republican legislative candidates with the hope of having more votes to push forward his agenda. So I think we will have a lot more clarity after this November election. I just wish we had it sooner rather than later.
I wonder how you think your job as state treasurer maybe has been different or affected by the state's budget crisis.
So I try not to complain about how the budget crisis has affected my office, because I am not a state university that's been looking at closing their doors. I'm not a social service provider that's had to lay people off and tell people, sorry, you don't get the services you depend upon. I'm not a MAP grant student who is told, sorry, you may not be able to go to college. There are consequences to my office. It makes it more difficult for me to manage my office, but nowhere near as badly as it's affecting other people in this state.
For people who may not know what the treasurer does, can you explain what your day-to-day job entails?
That is a great question, because I can tell you I go up and down the street and everyone knows a treasurer. Every organization you've ever been part of, whether it be your student council or your church or whatever, has a treasurer, and everyone knows it's the money guy. And so when I walk down the streets, people say, pass a budget, pay our bills. Those are two things
I don't do. The comptroller pays the bills, right?
Very good. So the comptroller pays the bills, and the General Assembly and the governor are in charge of passing a budget. I am the chief investment officer. So we invest the state's money, hoping to get a good return to make sure we don't lose money. But we also help families to invest in themselves. And so by that, I mean we manage our state's 529 college savings plans, helping families prepare for their children to go to college, community college, or a trade school. We're going to help families with children with disabilities save for their future. We're setting up a new program there. And we're going to help families save for retirement, something everyone knows they need to do, But if it's not easy, if it's not done through workplace deductions, too many Americans just don't get around to it.
I want to talk about that in a few minutes about the Secure Choice program, because I think people will be interested in hearing more about that. But getting back to as the state's chief investment officer, as you've heard the tone of both the Democrat and the Republican Party and the way that they've described Illinois, the national, international media attention being on The Daily Show, talking about what a terrible state we're in. What does that do to the state's image from an investment perspective?
It's not helpful. I think there are an awful lot of people out there that feel that running down this state helps them politically. And people ask me all the time, you know, who's winning this battle? Is it the governor? Is it the General Assembly? And I say, I don't know who's winning this battle, but I sure know who's losing it. And it's the people of this state. And when your governor goes out there and says, we've hit a low point in this state is nearly beyond repair, how do you then turn around and talk to companies and convince them to move here? How do you convince companies that are looking to leave to stay here when you're bad-mouthing and telling people that this is not a state worth investing in? I like to tell people, we have challenges. There's no denying those. We have large
pretty
unfunded
challenges.
Yeah, large unfunded liability. We went a year without a budget. We have various problems. But we have lots of advantages here still in our state. We have a highly trained workforce. We're centrally located. We have a great infrastructure system, whether it be our interstates, our railroads, or our airports. There's a lot of reasons why people should come here to Illinois. Illinois really is sort of the capital of the Midwest. And if you compare our income tax rates with neighboring states, we are very competitive. Yes, we have challenges. Yes, we need to work to improve our property tax system. We need to get some of our spending under control and to reduce our unfunded liability with pensions. But we can do it. We've not hit that tipping point. But we need to have real leadership that is interested in tackling problems and making tough decisions today, not kicking them down the road.
When you say we haven't hit that tipping point, what do you mean?
Well, I think that we can, with discipline, get ourselves out of this ditch. And there comes a point, though, where if you continue to run down the state and if we don't tackle our problems, you will see a massive exodus out of the state.
So you don't think we've seen that yet?
No, I mean, definitely people have left the state. But there is still a pool of talent here. There are still resources. There's infrastructure in place that make this a good state. And there's still a lot of people who love the state and want to fight for it.
So you don't think we're at a low point?
No. No. I mean, I think clearly we have had a really, really rough year where we became a laughingstock of the state. I mean, no other state in the country, I read an article the other day, went an entire year without passing budget. You know, that is not one of those we're number one moments we want to tout. Hopefully, a lesson was learned from this. And next year, in January, the governor and the General Assembly will come together and they will put us on a pathway and make some difficult decisions. There's no magic bullet out there. They're going to be tough decisions. But if we make them, if we take our medicine and have some discipline, Illinois can have a bright future.
Treasurer Ferrix, you mentioned a couple programs I wanted to talk about before you go. One of them is a new retirement program called Secure Choice that's expected to roll out next year. Can you explain why the state's launching a new retirement program for private companies?
So we're going to help people do what they know they need to do. You know, if you work for an employer that has a pension or a 401k with an employer match, chances are, very likely, you are on a path to saving for your retirement. About 85% of those people are on a good path. If you work for an employer that doesn't have a workplace retirement program, it's probably about 15% of those people are saving. And it's not because they're not as smart. It's not because they don't know. It's because it's just not easy. If we make it easy, and that's what we're going to do with automatic workplace deductions, we're going to work with the private sector on this. There are a lot of people who don't trust the state of Illinois to manage their money. We're going to work with the private sector here. Similarly to our college savings accounts, where money is deducted, it's invested, and it grows over time. You know, you get to exercise the miracles of compounding interest. If you get people saving in their 20s and 30s, they will have a lot more money ready for them in their retirement. Unfortunately, in America today, about a third of retiring Americans are going to rely on Social Security for 90% of their retirement income. Social Security was meant to be a safety net. It was meant to be one leg on a retirement stool. That is not going to provide. Social Security does not provide a retirement with dignity. It does not allow people to enjoy their golden years. They live near poverty.
We just have a minute or two left, but as thinking as you're saying this, I'm thinking about when you and I last talked on air, you were running for office for treasurer. And I'm wondering if there are things that you had wanted to do with this office that maybe you haven't been able to do because you've been so caught up in dealing with the state's fiscal mess and trying to manage that from an investment perspective.
Yeah, I think there are a limited number of hours in the day. We've had to make decisions about where to put resources. We'd like to do some other things as well. But we have a long list of things we want to accomplish in this office, and we're not done, and we're going to continue focusing on them. Mm-hmm. People ask me all the time, how do you like your job? And when I tell them I love it, they laugh.
They're surprised.
You must be joking. And I said, you know, if you wake up every day and concentrate on the things that are going wrong, the things you don't have any control over, you can get very frustrated. But if you wake up every day and say, what can I do to help people in the state? The treasurer's office gives me lots of opportunities to do that. And I run into people all the time. We're fighting to make sure the insurance companies are paying out life insurance benefits. And we've brought in over $500 million in unclaimed life insurance benefits. And we're going to bring in more into the state to help people. And I talk with these people who were beneficiaries, didn't know they're beneficiaries. And this is the kind of fight that makes a big difference in their lives.
We just have about 30 seconds left. Top three priorities apart from the budget for your office for the coming year?
Well, we got to get our Secure Choice program up and running. We are working on a new RFP for a college savings plan to save even more money for families. This last year we came in, we cut fees dramatically in one of our two programs. We're going to try to do the same thing with the other program. And then continue fighting the insurance companies that have sued me because they don't want to be forced to pay out life insurance benefits to people who have died.
Mike Ferricks is our Illinois State Treasurer. Treasurer, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Nyla.
Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, generating new knowledge and developing and evaluating new technologies and methodologies to better distribute scholarly knowledge. The University Library at Illinois.
Nyla Boodoo, and you're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. Today, Muslims around the world are celebrating Eid al-Fitr, a holy day that marks the end of Ramadan. During the month of Ramadan and all year long, Muslims give money to mosques and other organizations. That money is used to help those in need. It's called zakat. Joining us to learn more about this on the line from Springfield, we have Ali Nizamuddin. He's the president of the Islamic Society of Greater Springfield. And joining us from Chicago, Kadir Khan is the chairman of Zakat Chicago. Eid Mubarak, gentlemen. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. Eid Mubarak to you all.
Eid Mubarak to you too as well.
Thank you. Kadir, let's start with a basic question. I think many people are familiar with the idea of giving money to a church or giving money to a charity directly, of course. Is zakat like that?
Well, zakat is an obligation ordained upon all Muslims who own a certain amount of wealth which is above and beyond their normal needs. And it is there with them for a whole lunar year. Then they are obligated to pay a certain percentage of their savings above and beyond their own needs. And this is called zakat. So the minimum amount they should be in possession of is equal to the value of 3 ounces of gold, which is right now in the current day gold value. It comes out to be around $3,500 or so. So if anybody possesses that amount of wealth and this has been with that person, man or woman, for the whole lunar year, then he's obligated to pay zakat. And zakat is 2.5% of the amount that they are calculating zakat on. And this is an obligation and not just a voluntary charity. Everybody who is in this position has to pay it. And it is meant for certain people who are defined in the Quran. There are eight categories defined, but primarily they are poor and needy. And also there are people who are, stranded as travelers, and also people who are in debt and they cannot get out of the debt. And any good actions and that help the people, and that's called in the cause of Allah, and that's also a category.
So it's to help particularly, as you said, the needy, people who are in debt, and also people who maybe, I guess, people who need a special help this time of year. Ali, I wanted to ask you, because we heard Qadir talk about zakat. What's the difference in Islam between zakat and charity then?
Yeah, zakat, Qadir just referred to the ritualistic approach to zakat. But from a spiritual lens, the word zakat comes from the etymological root to purify, tazkiyah. So when we give zakat, we are purifying our money, but more importantly, we are purifying ourselves and trying to get rid of the avaricious side of the human self. Whereas sadaqah is a general category of charity, and sadaqah comes from the root sibq, which means to believe. So if I were to go to Walmart and purchase something and give money, I can get the item. If I were to go to a car lot and pay the money, I can get the car. But a believer has to have the belief that the money that that person gives in sadaqah, in charity, will be waiting for us on the day of judgment, and God will magnify it manifold. So zakat is the process of internal cleansing of the human self, and sadaqah is just simply another way to do that.
Mm-hmm. And so does this money, and Ali, I wonder if you can answer this, is this something that happens, this happens year round, but then also what happens during Ramadan? Is there special giving that is meant
Precisely.
To happen during Ramadan?
Precisely. These are magnified during the holy month of Ramadan, and these are magnified tenfold, 70-fold, 700-fold, and infinitum, because God is most gracious. So people prefer to give zakat and sadaqah in general during the month of Ramadan so that their charity has the greatest impact, both from a sociological point of view, but also from a spiritual point of view. That ultimately, during the month of Ramadan, we are trying to get closer and closer to God. The fact that we help the poor is a byproduct of our taqwa. Taqwa is this word that refers to Allah consciousness, being conscious and being aware of the existence of Allah in your life, the existence of God in your life, and as if we are in the presence of God. So the fact that we help poor people is simply a byproduct, and Ramadan gives us an opportunity to do that. And the Prophet Muhammad alayhi salam was the most generous person. He was the most generous person, but during the month of Ramadan, he was especially generous. And it is said that he was more generous than a cool breeze. So people defer to give the sadaqah and the zakat, especially during the month of Ramadan, a month of giving.
Ali, for you, as the president of the Islamic Society of Greater Springfield, how much money have you all raised? I don't know how big the Muslim community is in Springfield. I wonder if you could tell us that. And then how many have given to the mosque within Springfield?
Well, we have about 150 to 175 families. It is the only mosque or masjid in central Illinois, and the major employer is basically the state, because we are the state capital. So we collected, I believe, $8,000 in Zakatul Mal, which is what Khadir was referring to, and about $6,000 in Zakatul Fitr. Zakatul Fitr is a specific zakat that is given to the extreme, extreme poor of the society who cannot even afford food to eat. So if one is unable to afford a balanced meal, at least two or three balanced meals, then they qualify for Zakatul Fitr, whereas that is not the case with Zakatul Mal. Zakatul Mal, or the zakat and the wealth that Khadir just referred to, is to be given to the eight categories. But the extreme penury, the extreme poverty, those people qualify for Zakatul Fitr, which is the special zakat that is given before the Eid prayer, which was today. And so we collected about 6,000, and much of it we gave to Somalia. I remember when I was doing Umrah about 3 weeks ago, I saw in a scholar, an Islamic scholar on TV in Arabia, coming to tears because one of the questions was, I'm in Somalia and I have nothing to break my fast with. I can't even break my fast with water. I don't have any bread. And how can my fast be accepted? And the scholar began to cry. So we sent much of our zakat to Somalia, where there are truly, truly needy people. This country has some of the richest poor people on the face of the earth. And only when we travel to Somalia or Syria or Iraq do we really, or my home country, India, can we really, really appreciate the how poor people are in the rest of the world. It's an opportunity for us to help the poor.
Kadir, I wonder if you can explain for us with Zakat Chicago how you all were created. I know you're affiliated with the Council of Islamic Organizations of Greater Chicago. Why did you decide to create this one umbrella group for Chicago?
Well, first of all, let me clarify one of the things that Ali mentioned. Most people prefer to pay Zakat, the prescribed Zakat, in the month of Ramadan for the reasons he stated. But you can pay Zakat throughout the year. Since I mentioned that on your wealth that you possess above and beyond your needs, you have to have one lunar year pass by before the Zakat becomes
to calculate it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, but people can pay ahead of time or during the year. But what they normally do is, in order to mark a clear end of a year, they calculate their Zakat in the month of Ramadan and pay it for the reasons of additional blessings and rewards. But if they have already paid something ahead of time, they can subtract that and pay the rest. So coming back to your question about how we do it within Zakat Chicago, it's not a separate organization. It's a council's committee, Council of Islamic Organizations of Greater Chicago. We branded it as a Zakat Chicago with the name Zakat Chicago because we wanted to create the name awareness in the community, because the committee of council does not really ring the bell as to what we do. But the process that we are following, as after observing for many, many years, there are areas within the greater Chicago area that are so poor, so underprivileged, that they don't have any way of collecting Zakat from among themselves. But there are rich communities outside in the suburbs and the city also, who collect Zakat, and it is over and above and beyond the needs of the needy people within their immediate community. So we felt the need for channeling the Zakat to these areas. So Zakat Chicago really has set up a very effective and efficient network of channeling the money from the areas where it is in surplus to the areas where it is needed. And we have identified several distribution points. There are four or five masajids or mosques in those areas that distribute the Zakat. And there are six food pantries. And there are four or five weekend schools. And there are programs to rehabilitate prisoners. We have programs to give scholarship for students who cannot afford it. We have programs for abused women's shelter and many other such miscellaneous projects.
And those are all in the Chicagoland area, most of those, it sounds like?
Yes. We have actually deliberately chosen the horizon for us to be within the greater Chicago area, following a saying of the Prophet, peace be upon him, when he sent one of his companions to Yemen as a governor, his name in Maaz, he wanted to collect Zakat and send it to Medina, the capital of the Islamic State. But the Prophet said, it is an obligation God has ordained to be collected from the rich amongst you and to be distributed to the poor amongst you. So we have, therefore, it is all the scholars' opinion that first and foremost, category of people who deserve your Zakat, your poor relatives. Then the people who are within your community. So this is why we are focusing ourselves strictly to the local community of Greater Chicago area. As you probably saw on our billboard, our principle, operating principle, is local collection and local distribution. No money comes to us from outside. And we spend all of our money within the greater Chicago area.
And I know so far this year you've given away $460,000, so almost $500,000. And that's not counting what you all have received during Ramadan. Is that correct?
No, that includes everything.
That's everything.
That includes everything. So we start our year from the first of Ramadan.
Oh, so that's from last year's Ramadan then?
Yeah.
So okay.
Last year's Ramadan, but because most of our collections are during the month of Ramadan. We collect and people donate to us, you know, by sending a check or making payments online. And you can go to our website, zakatchicago.com, and there are various options that you can use to make payments. So it has become more and more recognized for the fact that we are doing this work very diligently. We have a very thorough process of due diligence in order to select the people and the points of distribution. And we also have periodic ongoing monitoring of where the money is going, how it's being used.
Well, you're also doing it online. Is it an unusual thing that people can give money online?
Yes, they certainly can. And this, if you ever have a chance to go to our website, go browse through it. You'll see there is a donate button. And you go in there, give you options. You can use your credit card, you can use PayPal, or you can mail a check directly to the address given. So lots of options are given because some people are not computer savvy. The young group are always, they want to do it online, so there is an option for them. And so we are trying to make it as easy as possible for people to donate.
Ali, we heard Kadir say the different organizations within Chicago that they're helping, and I know you mentioned Somalia was a focus for you, but you also have been working with food pantries and other organizations throughout the Springfield area, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We work with the St. John's Breadline, shelter for battered women as well, the Boys and Girls Club. We do clothing drives and food drives for them. Just 2 months ago, we did a huge water drive for the people of Flint. And we made a phone call to the Islamic Center of Flint, and we asked whether they have sufficient water. And they said that they only have 200 cases of water. So our masjid here in Central Illinois, the Islamic Society of Greater Springfield, along with UIS, University of Illinois Springfield, where I teach at, along with various synagogues and churches, we all came together. We had a two-week-long water drive, which was all over the newspapers as well as on the local TV as well. And we were able to fill one semi-truck full of bottled water, tens of thousands of bottled water that was distributed half to the Islamic Center of Flint and half to the Food Bank of Eastern Michigan. Because, you know, it's not something that we just prefer our own. Zakat or sadaqah can be given to Muslims, non-Muslims, because we're all brothers and sisters in humanity. So we distributed half to the Food Bank of Eastern Michigan and half to the Islamic Center, so that Islamic Center of Flint, so that they will have water to break their fast with. So
this year, that's something you've been able to do to help folks in Michigan.
Precisely.
Yeah, how much money and how much money have you all, the Islamic Society of Greater Springfield, how much money have you all been able to raise during, I don't know if you know your Ramadan totals yet?
Yeah, as I mentioned, Zakat al-Mal, we raised about 8,000, and Zakat al-Fitr, we raised about 6,000. I mean, various mosques, depending on the size, raise different amounts of money. But with respect to these types of projects, like the bread line and the homeless shelters and the overflow centers, or the water drive or the food drives, we did a very successful clothing drive for Syria and distributed the supplies to Rahma Relief, which is a humanitarian organization. So this is something that we constantly do. And when we do this, when we give back to the community, we are not doing them a favor. Where actually it enables us to get closer to God. You know, there's a beautiful hadith, which is a statement of our noble messenger, who taught us that God will say on the day of judgment that I was hungry and you didn't feed me. And man will say, oh, Lord of the worlds, how can you be fed? You are the Lord of the worlds. And then God will say, if you would have gone to a poor person and fed him or her, you would have found me with them. You know, likewise with the thirsty and the, you know, you didn't clothe me. How can you be clothed, O God of the world? If they were poor people in our in the community, and if you would have clothed them, you would have found me with them.
Yeah, so it's a good message for everyone. Thank you for sharing with us. That's Ali Nizamuddin, who's president of the Islamic Society of Greater Springfield. Thanks as well to Kadir Khan, chairman of Zakat Chicago. Eid Mubarak. Thank you.
Eid Mubarak. Take care.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Peoria has a $200 million stormwater problem with overflow and raw sewage discharging into the Illinois River. Its plan is to help solve that by introducing green infrastructure throughout the city. Our intern Ben Thomas Payne went to Peoria last week to walk through one of the city's pilot programs in the city's warehouse district.
I'm Anthony Corso, and I'm the director of the innovation team for the city of Peoria. We're actually on site right now for a pilot project to demonstrate the green infrastructure, a complete green streets project approach, and how we can get multiple community benefits. This is the warehouse district for the city of Peoria, and it's a portion of the old industrial zone. Certainly had a lot of distilleries and things back when this was the whiskey capital of the world. A lot of different industries grew up here, and it's still very industrial in its use, but it's starting to slowly transform. So we're looking across the street, and what you'll see is you'll see maybe a parking lane and then what used to be three lanes of traffic, one-way traffic, and then another parking lane on the other side. So it's a pretty wide street, but the traffic here doesn't justify such a wide street. And so one of the strategies to align with the work that's been done and the complete streets policy of the city, and you know, bringing this back to maybe the character that it used to have, was that we're going to narrow up the street. We're going to have two traffic lanes. And on each side of those traffic lanes, we're going to have bicycle lanes. And then we're going to have parking that is on the street as well. But you know, at the ends of the parking spaces, we'll have what are called bulb outs. It's where the corners are actually extended out into the street so that you can, it's a shorter walking distance for pedestrians to cross the street. And it also gets at the real psychological component of driving, where you may post a 25 or 30 mile an hour, 35 mile an hour speed limit, but if your streets are really wide, you tend to be comfortable driving fast, and hence you do. And what that does is kind of, you know, helps reduce the speed of drivers, and so it makes it safer for all users. So automobiles, bicyclists, pedestrians, and all other users should have a kind of safer, more comfortable experience on the street. You know, there are best practices here where you bring street trees back, and you'll notice we're standing under a tree right now. It's because standing out on a day like today, even though it's beautiful weather, in the sun is really uncomfortable. So it discourages people from walking, maybe from their office down to get a bite to eat. Instead, they're going to hop in their car and drive a few blocks. So those details are really important. You know, the street trees being spaced appropriately. So within maybe 10 years, you've got a canopy that provides shade for pedestrians.
Thanks to Ben Thomas Payne for that. And Anthony Corso is joining us now from he's on the line from his office in Peoria. Hi, Anthony. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Anthony, we were just hearing about how you're trying to solve this stormwater problem. I thought we should start with the stormwater issue. That's part of why you're doing all of this, the green infrastructure and the green streets for the cities. So I know there's some overflow and raw discharge into the Illinois River. What's actually happening?
Well, so this is a larger conversation. This is an ongoing, like 700 plus communities across the United States. We've got typically older portions of town that were built out with sewers to drain roadways, and then indoor plumbing came online, and those were plugged into those same pipes. And so, what happened? Fast forward is you get to the point where rain events and snow melt, even sometimes, depending on the city and the sewer sheds. Cause basically an overwhelming of the system, and you get diluted raw sewage that can flow into waterways. And so it's not a wholly unique problem to the city of Peoria, but it is something that cities have been grappling with, particularly since the Clean Water Act, and trying to clean up those kinds of issues with infrastructure.
Right, and that's why the EPA, I know, has gotten involved. How will these streets and green improvements help?
So the city's been looking at least for the last couple of years, you know, the innovation of using green as opposed to gray, which is pipes and tanks. And that was so the Public Works in particular looking at, well, this is the innovation that's happening in this space. And what the innovation team started to work on, and my team started to work on, is like, how do we leverage that? How do we expand that and allow for multiple community benefits? And so this green infrastructure, looking at all those kind of co-benefits that come along with it, not just beautification, but obviously if you're going to do, traffic calming or green infrastructure, it can also function as traffic calming, and you can enhance and add street trees, and you can do all these other things. You can create some synergies with local businesses and those types of things.
What's been the reaction from the EPA so far? Because I know part of your job is to convince the EPA that this is a part of a modification that will help, correct?
Well, certainly there's a team from the city, and it is an ongoing legal negotiation, but by and large, the concept has been well received, and so the details are being worked out. But the idea of taking this in Peoria, roughly 8 square miles of the city that's a combined sewer area, and you know, resolving the issues with combined sewer overflows with this kind of network of complete green streets, or using this green infrastructure throughout to really connect people and places to, you know, get those benefits while removing those gallons. That's the, you know, the important, removing those gallons of runoff and, you know, kind of preventing those combined sewer overflows to the greatest extent possible. That's the goal. And I think it's been largely pretty well received because of, you know, it's something that you're going to be able to see as opposed to maybe buried pipes and tanks. This is something that residents will realize, and really the end users, those people that, that use the city and travel through the city, will see the enhancements and the, and all benefit from it all at once. So,
yeah, I wonder, Anthony, if you can connect the dots for us for how dealing with stormwater relates to other issues like transportation and walkability, how you sort of put all of these, how you are able to connect all of these things.
It is kind of you know, a natural evolution or re-evolution. I mean, this was always all connected historically, and we got a little bit away from that, and at least the latter half of the 20th century, really focusing on the automobile and not paying as much attention to the pedestrian and the cyclist and those sorts of things. And so, you know, it really does tie together. And if you look internationally, even the work that's going on within cities is they're really taking a close look at the streets. In North America in particular, it's our primary public space. So rebalancing the equation for users really makes a lot of sense. We don't have a lot of squares and plazas in most cities and small towns. And so, you know, making this public space, these streets, work better for all users is really important to increasing livability and resilience and those kinds of things.
Do you see a time when you think that the residents of Peoria will be more out of their cars, there'll be more walkability, there'll be a little bit more of what you sort of envision, as you said, within 10 years, having more streets, more people on bikes and kind of in those spaces instead of in their cars?
Yeah, I mean, it takes time, but I think, you know, with every project, you know, once there's an official green light and we move forward, and I think even realizing this with the pilot project that was referenced before, you know, measuring those impacts, seeing, you know, how a pedestrian use and, you know, how many more people are walking to use that and to get to those spaces, how many more people are biking because now it's more comfortable to bike on that street. So we hope to see, obviously, some very short-term or medium-term impacts, but it is something that takes time as you're building out infrastructure, and, you know, it's really over a generation probably that the transformation will be taking place. And, you know, we hope it happens that way and that we really realize all those benefits that we're targeting.
I'm speaking with Anthony Corso. He's the Chief Innovation Officer for Peoria. And Anthony, how are you all communicating with Peoria residents about these green innovations or about sort of how the city sees this as an important step in its future?
Right. And you know, that's a great point, because that public engagement and that outreach is so important. And it's not just to even the residents. It's even understanding that, you know, the innovation model coming in, it really is to create some space and some time and some resources to, you know, tap those staff people that are out there all the time and see opportunities for improvement, and it can share those and they can be explored further. But certainly going out to the businesses, going out to the end users, and what we've done is we've had a number of committees and outreach events and including for this pilot project, 2 public meetings where we really talk about the goals for a green street and the goals for a complete street and how this might impact, you know, the residents that are there and the neighbors, as well as, you know, folks that live outside of the neighborhood or visitors to those locations, and kind of have those public conversations and get feedback based on kind of the principles that were set forth.
Anthony, you're the city's first chief innovation officer. I know you left a job as an urban planner in Chicago to come back to your hometown and then to take this position. Why did you want to do that?
I came back and actually was in private practice for a while before jumping in with the city a few years later. But the you know, it's an incredible opportunity from my perspective, certainly, to come back to your hometown. You know, take these best practices and these ideas from across the country and around the world and really use them to transform, you know, your hometown for the better. And so it was just kind of, you know, something I couldn't keep myself away from. And it's been some incredible engagement, incredible conversations. And, you know, so here I am.
Well, as you're talking about the walkability and having bike paths, those are things certainly we've seen really a big change in the city of Chicago within the walkability and the bike paths. Certainly within the past couple of years, that's been a really important part of Mayor Emanuel's making the downtown and the city more accessible. He thinks for younger people who want to bike to work. Do you think it's harder to transplant those ideas to smaller cities like Peoria, where you maybe don't have the tax base and the resources?
Yeah, there are always challenges. I think the great part here is that, you know, over the last few years in particular, there's been a lot more support, and certainly city council, the mayor, the city manager, and staff and department heads have made this a priority, that they understand that, you know, maintaining talent, drawing new talent, you know, young professionals in particular, but certainly residents want those walkable communities, and in some cases restoring walkable communities and access to amenities. And those are this kind of infrastructure is what, you know, keeps or brings those kinds of amenities and those people to these neighborhoods to live, work, and play. And so, you know, I think that it's been kind of, you know, it kind of became less so over a number of generations. And now, you know, we have the slow migration back to really about cities for people. And so, you know, I think there is a good bit of support and a good bit of opportunity, no matter what size the city is, to really figure out what you can do, whether it's restriping a street if you don't have the budget to rebuild one, to really kind of, again, look at those, you know, what you can do for the end users to make it a street for all users, and really look at streets as public space and as connectors of people and places.
Anthony, I know Peoria is only one of 12 cities across the country that got a Bloomberg Philanthropies grant to try to work on these municipal issues, create the I-team. What else are you guys working on?
So we just started into kind of discussions and research in the middle of the second priority. So the teams do kind of work from, a large issue, which is identified as a priority for the city. And then as they start working into starting programs, they start identifying and doing research on new issues that are a big issue for the city. And so certainly there's a neighborhood scale economic development conversation happening now that we're just starting research on to look into. So we'll be looking more at some of these ideas that dovetail quite well, honestly, at least in the combined sewer area with the combined sewer area work, but certainly benefit the entire city to really look at, you know, what were historically kind of these economic engines for neighborhoods. How do we bring those back online and use those to create opportunity for maybe folks that live in those neighborhoods that are looking to grow their business or have that entrepreneurial spirit and looking for an opportunity to do something that would provide a value to their neighbors and to their community. So that's where the conversation is going now. It's a really exciting one to have, and I think good timing to have it.
Anthony, one last question for you. Do you think that as other cities are looking to maybe try to figure out how to innovate more, do you think having a position like yours, a chief innovation officer, is necessary to be able to bridge different departments?
I think that it's like many of the things that are around now in terms of positions that, you know, the ultimate goal is to put yourself out of business. But it does, you know, it is an enabler in the sense that it provides some additional resources and avenues to bring people together around, you know, common issues and really find, you know, use a way of thinking, a way of working that helps add capacity for this innovation, you know, to think about how the different departments could work together towards a common goal, to realize, you know, and identify who those partners are in the community, whether individuals or organizations that can really be part of the solution more so than they've been in the past, for a number of reasons. And so I do think this really does, you know, add some real advantage and capacity to local government to work in this way and have this type of mechanism. But I am obviously biased in that regard.
Well, thanks for taking the time to be with us. That's Anthony Corso. He's the Chief Innovation Officer in Peoria.
Thank you very much.
That's all the time we have for today on the 21st. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about home birth. We're going to be speaking with the director of the first downstate independent birth center in Bloomington Normal. It's the first one outside of Chicago. They just started accepting new patients this week. We're also going to be talking to mothers about why they choose to do home birth. You can always find all the information to contact on us our website. That's www.21stshow.org. There you'll find ways to download our podcasts, whether that's via the NPR One app, iTunes, or Android. You can find our voicemail and email and social media links to our Facebook and Twitter page. Again, that's at www.21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.